Welcome to HealthComm Central, where we unpack theories and frameworks that can help you create more effective communication to improve both health outcomes and health equity. I'm your host, Karen Hilliard, behavioral scientist and longtime communication practitioner. If you're looking for fresh approaches that get real results, you are in the right place. So let's get started. Hello, HealthComm nerds and HealthComm novices. Welcome to another episode of HealthComm Central. It is spring where I am, and everything around me is covered with green and yellow powder, otherwise known as pollen. So if I sound a little scratchy voice today, that is why, but I am well, and I hope you are well too. We're going to close out the recent brief series that I've been doing on social marketing by talking today about the importance of the audience in social marketing. This is the fourth episode in the brief series, and there is also an introduction to social marketing that is in episode 6. So if you haven't listened to those other episodes, episode 6, an intro to social marketing, episode 26, 27, and 28, also on social marketing, I encourage you to go back and take a listen to those because everything we talk about today is going to make much more sense if you do. We're going to be talking about three things today. First, what we really mean by putting the audience first. Second, some ways that you can conduct audience research on a shoestring. And third, how the social marketing approach overlaps with other concepts like community participatory research and racial equity work, especially when it comes to the idea of centering an audience that has been marginalized in the past. In talking about audiences today, we are not going to be talking about segmentation per se, although that is obviously a critical part of any communication process. But segmentation, that is enough to be its own episode, and it will be an episode in the future. So we won't cover that today. Instead, we're going to just focus on putting the audience first in a social marketing process. So number one, if you've heard me talk about social marketing, you know that I say over and over again that it is audience-centric. But what does that actually mean? Well, in social marketing, every single thing is from the perspective of the audience. We want to understand as much as possible about their knowledge, their attitudes, beliefs, practices, aka behaviors, but we also want to get a true sense of their values and needs. And a quick aside here, some people mistakenly think that that first part, knowledge, attitudes, beliefs, and practices, somehow encompasses values and needs. And there is a little bit of overlap sometimes, but these are really distinct things. Values and needs are the levers by which you can motivate behavior. And remember, in social marketing, we are in the behavior change business. We may have to do a little bit of education on the front end that increases knowledge, and we certainly do things that lower barriers or increase perceived benefits, and those things may, in fact, change beliefs and attitudes. But increasing knowledge and changing attitudes is never the central objective of social marketing. And we almost never, never try to change values and needs. Instead, what we are trying to do is work with them, work with existing values and needs by exchanging one behavior for another and meeting people's abiding values and needs that don't change, meeting those the same way or better with a new, more desirable behavior. So we really have to understand those values and needs in a deep way in order to do that. Now, you'll probably notice that I mentioned knowledge, attitudes, beliefs and practices, and values and needs, but I did not mention demographics. Of course, you're going to want some idea of demographics for a campaign. Demographics help you to pick appropriate channels and get the look and feel and language of a campaign just right. Demographics can also help us to ensure that we use inclusive images. If equity is an issue, and usually it is, right, then race, ethnicity, sexual orientation, gender, health status, income, education level, all those demographic factors can be critically important. But I'm not really calling out demographics as one of the things that requires you to do audience research, because demographics are often pretty readily available. Usually they're collected by somebody else or they're far more obvious. So I'm not worried that you're going to forget to incorporate demographics. In fact, usually what I see is that it goes in the other direction. And all too often we see campaigns that are built primarily on demographics. And that's a big mistake for a couple of reasons. First, a demographic group is obviously not a monolith. All men are not the same. All 18 to 29-year-olds are not the same. I mean, even in a very narrowly defined group, like let's say my group is Hispanic and Latino women in their 30s who identify as queer and have a 4-year college degree, that group is not all going to think alike or have the same motivations. So we can make some big and often very incorrect assumptions when we focus mostly on demographics. And if you get pushback from anyone on this idea, I would encourage you to look at some of the scales and measures that have been developed over the years to measure cultural or racial identity. There's one, for example, that my research colleagues and I used a few years ago called the Black Identity Classification Scale. And it divides Black audiences into 16 different identity subgroups. So definitely not a monolith. Plus, putting someone into one particular demographic box ignores the idea of intersectionality, the other identities that a person has. And as we as a society move away from socially imposed labels and allow people more choice in how they identify themselves, for example, allowing somebody to identify as multiracial rather than a single race, we can't assume that people are going to fall into the same neat demographic categories that we have traditionally relied upon. The other really important thing about demographics is that they are not motivators for a lot of people, even when it comes to cultural identity. Values and needs are motivators. People don't do a thing just because they have a certain demographic label. Of course, sometimes cultural or racial or gender or generational identity can be the thing that prompts somebody's behavior, but usually it's tied to even deeper values and motivations, and it's only going to be when identity or heritage or culture is a really strong value for that individual. And that's not going to be true of everybody. To truly understand the drivers of people's behavior, we have to look instead to things that are much less obvious, psychographics instead of demographics. Psychographics are all the things that are hidden inside somebody's mind. So knowledge, attitudes, beliefs, values, needs, all of those things tend to be inside a person's head. We can track a lot of practices or behaviors of people because a lot of those are observable. And some of those behaviors will be good indicators to us of the people's knowledge, attitudes, beliefs, values, needs. But on the other hand, there are plenty of behaviors that are not directly observable, and we're going to need to find out what they are. Sometimes we can figure out ways to measure these hidden or unobservable behaviors, but quite often we have to ask people about all of these things: knowledge, attitudes, beliefs, practices, values, needs, all of it requires up-to-date research. Not guesses, not assumptions, not hunches, not stereotypes, not research from 10 years ago. Remember that successful corporate marketers never scrimp on audience research. And motivating, not educating or coercing, is the role of marketing. That ultimately is what it really means when we talk about putting the audience first in social marketing. Doing the work to understand their values and needs first and letting the campaign flow from there. Now, people totally nod along with me when I'm telling them this and are like, yes, yes, audience research, of course. But at some point, from some of the clients that I work with or some of the professionals that I train, I will often start hearing, yeah, but unfortunately, we can't do that. And you know, sometimes it's budget, sometimes it's time. Sometimes people tell me, well, we already know a lot about this audience. Sometimes from federal public health professionals, I will hear about how their hands are tied by the rule that they can only talk to 9 people or fewer before they have to file paperwork for approval from OMB, the Office of Management and Budget. A lot of people struggle with IRB approval, the institutional review board of whatever organization or university they are working for. Other people will say that they have a hard-to-reach population. Maybe they literally can't talk to them. And I'm not disputing that these are real issues, but if you're trying to do social marketing and you're not really doing audience research, you're not really doing social marketing. You have to do the research. But fortunately, there are some workarounds. And that brings me to my second point, which is how to do audience research on a shoestring. When you need to do as much as you can, but you don't have the luxury of doing it in the perfect way. Now, the perfect way will vary, but let's say in a perfect world, you'd conduct in-depth interviews and focus groups, and then maybe you would survey a few thousand people, and you'd have to unpack that survey with some more interviews. And that's just the formative phase. Later, you'd do message testing and materials testing directly with your audience. But this is not a perfect world, and sometimes you can't do those things. So what can you do? Let me tell you quickly 5 tips that I have. Number one, there's really no excuse not to do interviews directly with your audience. If you can't do them directly with your audience, then you can do in-depth interviews with key informants, with partners, practitioners, people who know your audience. Now, a second very real problem for people who work for federal agencies is the Paperwork Reduction Act. If you're not familiar with the name of that, I know that if you work for a federal agency, you're probably familiar with the rule that limits you to talking with groups of 9 people or fewer, or else you have to go through the whole OMB process that can take months, that can require a lot of paperwork, and that can just be a huge hassle with lots of hoops to jump through. And that's a real problem if, say, it would be really great to interview like 12 or 15 people, but you're limited to talking to only 9. Or if you would like to do 3 or 4 focus groups of 5 or 6 people each, but again, you're limited to a total of 9 people. So what do you do? Well, you have to follow the law. But did you know that the rule is actually that you cannot ask the same set of questions to more than 9 individuals? Yeah, that's it. So for example, you can have several different groups of 9 individuals as long as you use a completely different interview guide for each one. You can't overlap any of the questions, but if you ask completely different questions, you can get another 9 interviews or another 18 or 36 or however many you need, as long as for each group of 9 individuals, you've got a new questionnaire with different questions. So don't let the rule of 9 or fewer inhibit the amount of audience research that you do. Number 3, piggyback on partner surveys, interviews, or focus groups. This seems kind of obvious, but so often people aren't doing it. You want to talk with your partner organizations about research that they may be doing and find out if they would consider including some questions that you provide. Number 4, use online sources of conversation and interaction. Asking people informally on social media, in online forums, is totally okay. If it is a public forum, observable by anyone, and you don't include any identifiable information in gathering and reporting the information there is fine. It will be exempt as human subjects research when you submit your plan to any IRB, any institutional review board. You can also systematically analyze conversations that are already happening in public online groups, and you can even insert your own prompts. This is information that is just there waiting to be gathered. So use those resources as much as possible. And number 5, think about other campaigns or organizations that are targeting similar audiences or issues and who have had the ability to do extensive audience research. Think about what their campaigns and messages can tell you. If you're trying to target people with diabetes, for example, what can you learn at looking at how a big pharmaceutical company is targeting the same audience? If you're trying to target high school athletes about concussions, how is the same group being targeted by companies that sell athletic apparel or sports drinks? And of course, if there's a company that's selling a behavior that you want people to stop doing, that you hope to exchange with another behavior, whatever values those messages are focused on to sell that behavior, those are the values you really need to pay attention to. So those are five quick ways: interviews, developing different interview guides, piggybacking with partners, using public online forums, and learning from other campaigns. These are just a few quick ideas, but they are low cost or no cost. They don't take much time, and they don't run afoul of any rules. There is absolutely no excuse not to do some audience research. So we've talked about the importance of the audience. We've talked about how to get the kind of information that you need. Let's talk about a third key point when it comes to social marketing and audiences: how the social marketing approach overlaps with concepts like community participatory campaigns and the idea of centering the audience, especially an audience that has been marginalized in the past. You know, for 50 years now, social marketing has been prioritizing audiences and what motivates them. But social marketing is also a process that lends itself extremely well to centering the experience of marginalized audiences, making their perspectives the central axis around which discourse on a topic can revolve, rather than revolving around the perspectives of the people belonging to the dominant race or culture. And those last words I said actually come from a theoretical framework called public health critical race praxis that offers a fantastic approach. Public health critical race praxis is a framework that we're going to come back to for an entire episode in the future. But for now, I'm going to put a link to a couple of articles on it in the episode notes. The other thing that social marketing can lend itself well to is power sharing and decision making with audiences. Everything from which members of the audience to talk to what questions to ask, to making decisions about the purpose and focus of a campaign, and all of the messages, strategies, and tactics. Social marketing can be a very community participatory framework. Centering the audience, sharing power with the audience, both of those things make it more likely that you will also center equity or apply an equity lens to your social marketing campaign, that you'll ask questions about racism, discrimination, privilege, power, as part of the audience research process. And of course, social marketing works hard not just to change downstream behaviors, but to change midstream and upstream policies and systems so that barriers to healthy behavior are lowered and that sustainable change takes place and longstanding inequity is corrected. These things are a natural follow-on to what social marketing has always done so much more deliberately than other approaches: putting the audience first. As we've talked about today, what we really mean by that is getting inside the head of our audience so their values and needs drive the campaign and can motivate behavior change. It means doing the requisite audience research to make that happen. No excuses. And it is highly compatible with audience approaches in racial equity and community participatory research and campaign design, if you make the effort to center the experience of the audience and to share power with them. As always today, I'm putting some stuff in the episode notes that you'll want to check out, links to research and helpful resources on these topics. We will be back next week with brand new topics. No more series for a while, but instead we'll be working our way through some behavioral theories and frameworks and other tools that need to be part of your bag of tricks. If you have a chance this week, tell a friend or colleague about HealthCom Central, and it's always so helpful if you can leave a rating or review. Until next time, stay well, stay safe, and stay science-based. Bye for now. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment now to leave a rating and review. Be sure to subscribe to HealthCom Central on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you have friends and colleagues who should be part of our community, please share the link.